Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast aims to discuss the evolving treatment landscape in EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer and how biomarker testing is becoming a crucial element in both early stage and metastatic disease to guide best treatment approaches in the first and subsequent lines of therapy. The panel will also address the latest data from the World Lung Cancer Conference and ESMO 2021, and how this may impact clinical practice. Financial support for this medical education activity has been provided by an educational grant from AstraZeneca.
My name is Pasi Yen. I'm the director of the Lowe Center for Thoracic Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this discussion on EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, taking in the latest data presented at the World Lung Cancer Conference and at the ESMO 2021 meeting. I'm here with my colleagues, Dr. Tanyan Ragawatawana, a medical oncologist from the Ramathibodi Hospital in Bangkok, Thailand, and Dr. Neil Navani, an interventional pulmonologist from the University College London in the United Kingdom. Today, we will discuss three different topics. How is the use of EGFR TKIs evolving in non-small cell lung cancer? How important is it that clinicians increase their focus on biomarker testing? And what are the options for patients progressing on EGFR inhibitors? We'll start our first discussion on how is the use of EGFR TKIs evolving in non-small cell lung cancer. There's an evolving treatment paradigm for early stage non-small cell lung cancer. Patients who have undergone successful surgical resection, as well as adjuvant therapy, if they have an EGFR mutation, based on the ADAURA study, they are recommended to receive adjuvant osimertinib for 3 years in patients who have the common EGFR exon 19 deletion or L858R mutation. In the ADAURA trial, there was a significant decrease in the disease-free recurrence at 2 years in patients who received adjuvant osimertinib compared to those who did not. In EGFR negative patients, the recommendation continues to be adjuvant chemotherapy. And at the ESMO 2021 meeting, there was data presented on adjuvant atezolizumab, also showing a decrease in disease-free survival and something that will continue to evolve over the next months to years to come. In patients in first-line setting with metastatic disease, patients who have exon 19 deletions and an L858R mutation, the recommendation, the category 1 recommendation is for osimertinib as first-line data based on the improvement in both progression-free survival and overall survival compared to prior generation EGFR inhibitors, gefitinib and erlotinib. In patients who are started on systemic therapy, such as chemotherapy, and are discovered to have an EGFR mutation, different choices exist as to when to transition that individual to an EGFR inhibitor, either at the completion of systemic therapy or maintenance therapy, or interruption of systemic therapy followed by transitioning either to osimertinib or to a prior generation EGFR inhibitor. Now, combination approaches have been and continue to evolve, and they are in two major categories here. One are anti-angiogenic agents, as mentioned, bevacizumab or ramucirumab. In both cases, when added to erlotinib, there has been a significant improvement in progression-free survival, favoring the combination over a single agent erlotinib. We do not have complete data on overall survival at this point, although in the NEJ-026 trial, there was no improvement in overall survival statistically, although some numerical improvement. Over the last year or so, we've also seen now emerging data on chemotherapy and early generation EGFR inhibitors. Here are two trials with gefitinib and carboplatin and pemetrexed versus gefitinib alone, one conducted in Japan and one conducted in India. And both showed impressive improvements in both progression-free as well as overall survival, and really have reinvigorated the idea of combining chemotherapy with EGFR inhibitors, something that was done in the early 2000s when EGFR inhibitors were first discovered and entered the clinic, but something that has subsequently fallen out of favor until the emergence of these two clinical trials, and I think a good discussion point for our group. So we'll move on to the discussion, first let's talk about the adjuvant setting, and maybe I'll start with Dr. Navani. The approval of osimertinib in the adjuvant setting clearly means that we have to know which of our patients have an EGFR mutation in order to offer this treatment. Tell us a little bit about, in your institution, When do you test patients who have had surgery for an EGFR mutation, and how does that practice pattern change since the approval of adjuvant osimertinib?
Thanks, Pasi. So this is obviously a really exciting development now, where our patients have access to osimertinib in the adjuvant setting. In the UK, we'd had fairly well established biomarker testing for patients with advanced disease. So really bringing that forward into the adjuvant setting has proven to be a little bit of a challenge, but hopefully one that we're now really beginning to get to grips with. I think our patients are really keen to have a targeted treatment. Certainly when I speak to patients in around the time of surgery and discuss treatments after surgery, they're really excited to know about the opportunity to have a targeted treatment. And I wonder whether this will mean that there'll be an increase in uptake of adjuvant treatments as well. Because historically, particularly in the UK, uptake of adjuvant treatments, so chemotherapy historically, has been low. So it really brings to the fore, I think, the importance of biomarker testing now for early stage disease. Certainly in most centres in the UK, this is now done in a reflex manner. So not just on the surgical sample, but also on the pre-operative sample, usually a CT-guided biopsy, perhaps an EBUS-guided biopsy. That sample will now be sent for full biomarker testing. So we're able to have those conversations with our patients to inform treatments in the adjuvant setting.
And is how you test the same in the adjuvant setting as in the metastatic setting? Meaning, do you do a broad panel testing for patients following surgery or just test for an EGFR mutation?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think at the moment, the practicalities dictate that we do the same broad panel testing for everyone. And that really reflects the fact that we are doing reflex testing. There's very little bandwidth to understand whether the patient has come from an early stage setting or a late stage setting. And it's far more cost effective for our pathology departments and far more time effective to simply reflex test all samples. And as you say, as the majority of the time now is next generation sequencing.
Great, thanks. Nana, tell us about what happens in Thailand. Do you test surgical cases for EGFR mutations at the moment or not yet?
So right now, so it's a bit different in UK because we cannot reimburse osimertinib for the adjuvant setting at all. So that's why, and it's not reflex EGFR testing right now, but I think for the patients who pays out of the pocket, the oncologist start to discuss with the patients, and most of us use the surgical specimen because that specimen is bigger and we have lots of cells in the surgical specimen, and we have the timing for waiting because most of if the patients have the indication to use the osimertinib, so most of them receive the adjuvant chemotherapy first, so we have a couple of times to wait for the result. And the other things, personally, I test for the EGFR testing in the early stage lung cancer for a long time because of in Thailand, the climate is very hot. So, and the storage of the pathological block is in the normal temperature room, is not in the air conditioning room. So that's why personally I favor to test it in the early stage first. Otherwise, if we keep it for a long term, and the DNA probably will destroy because of the climate. So that's my personal practice.
Great. So clearly some practice pattern differences around the world. And I will say for us, although we do testing that is oncology ordered for patients in the metastatic setting for NGS-based testing, in the adjuvant setting in surgical cases, we now reflex test, but only for EGFR mutations. So there's some differences in testing based on the patient, just because of only the approval so far of osimertinib in that setting. Nana, maybe I'll turn the next question to you in terms of combination therapies. You know, there's data on anti-angiogenic agents, giving chemotherapy with drugs like gefitinib. Are there instances where you would think about a combination therapy for a patient as opposed to single agent EGFR TKI, and maybe elaborate what those instances would be?
Yeah, so currently, for the data that Professor Harnes mentioned previously from ESMO and Volung, so I believe the combinations would be one of the choice of the treatment for the first line treatment. But the things that I concern is the toxicity, because the combination is come with the toxicity. So that is one of my concern. And for the other ones is probably in some of the special condition, for example, in the exon 21, the combination of the alotinib and the ramucirumab probably be an option. And the other ones from the Beverly study this year, the smoker or former smoker population might be have more benefit in the combination setting.
Yeah, absolutely. Some interesting data there suggesting that the combo has some, the anti-angiogenesis combo has some potential increased benefit in current or former smokers who have EGFR mutant lung cancer. What about chemotherapy? Do you ever give chemotherapy and an EGFR inhibitor together? I mean, the data is pretty impressive on the PFS and OS with a gefitinib combination. I'm just wondering if there's any uptake of that in real practice.
So actually, I have not used it in the first line setting. So personally, I use it in the later line setting in the era of that we don't have the options for treating the patients who fell with the first or second generation EGFR TKI in the past before osimertinib approval. But and right now, probably I use it in the later line treatment as well. So that before the study showed the benefit. But one thing, because that two study is just done in Japanese and in India, so probably we need the data that's more generalized in the other populations too. And the other thing is, as Dr. Harney said, previously, we have the study in the FASAC study that we use the intercalated EGFR TKI with the chemotherapy in the first line setting. So I'm not quite sure if we have some of the study that trying to compare the continuation of the EGFR TKI or the intercalated one. So what do you think about this, Dr. Harney?
Well, I think I think this will continue to evolve, and I would say it'll continue to evolve in two areas. One is that, of course, there's chemotherapy. There's a chemotherapy osimertinib trial ongoing as well, the FLAURA2 trial, to understand does chemotherapy also add to a drug like osimertinib. I think the second issue will be is who actually needs combination therapy, meaning that, you know, we all know that there are patients that we give an EGFR TKI and they can do great for many, many years. But there are some patients who do not, and they progress at the median or below the median, and maybe they have some kind of high-risk cancer that requires chemotherapy. I don't know that we know yet how to identify those people, but it may be that the intensified therapies are ultimately for subsets of individuals and not everyone. But let's see how this this field evolves. Let's move on to our second topic on how important is that clinicians increase their focus on biomarker testing. Now, if we look at sort of current recommendations for biomarker testing, and this is absolutely an ever-evolving field as our number of therapies continue to change and evolve. Of course, histologic diagnosis is important, determining a subtype of lung cancer, adenocarcinoma versus squamous cell cancer, doing extensive genomic testing on adenocarcinoma patients, as well as PD-L1 testing. It's less so in the squamous cell population. And then, of course, using the information to select the appropriate therapy for our patients. And there are, of course, emerging biomarkers in this field as well for therapies that are recently approved, for example, in MET mutant lung cancer, KRAS mutant lung cancer, where we have our first approval, HER2 mutant lung cancer, where there was exciting data being presented at ESMO, as well as many others to come. And so I think this is going to continue to evolve over time. And of course, there are considerations into this turnaround time, complexity. We all want results yesterday because we want to use this to inform treatment for our patients. But of course, recognize that time goes into this as well. So let's start with Neil, who is obviously often being asked to get sufficient tissue to do the biomarker testing. So tell us a little bit about your approach and how do you assure that, number one, there is sufficient tissue, and what kind of communication do you have with the pathologist to make sure that that takes place?
Thanks, Pasi. So tissue acquisition, as you know now, is really in the spotlight, and pulmonologists, I think, have a really key role here along with our interventional radiology colleagues. So I think it's really important that pulmonologists take an increasing interest in lung cancer, particularly the novel approvals, the novel targets that are available, and the novel agents that our patients can now have. And it's really vital to work closely with our pathology colleagues, collecting data on how good our samples are, working out why some samples fail, and using quality improvement techniques, perhaps in every single center, to improve the quality of tissue that we deliver to our pathology colleagues for biomarker testing. Because this really is now, as you say, Pasi, with all of those biomarkers, really mandatory for our patients. This is really crucial for sort of best patient care. In my own setting, at UCL, we tend to use a lot of endobronchial ultrasound EBUS procedures for aspirating central mediastinal lymph nodes and lung masses. We found that to be a very efficient way of extracting good quality DNA and RNA if required, and then successfully testing in a reflex manner using next generation sequencing. So that's usually our standard of care currently.
And let me ask you a practical question. When you're doing a biopsy, an endobronchial ultrasound, or mediastinal node sampling, is there a pathologist there in the procedure suite to say, yes, there's sufficient tissue, or yes, there's tumor tissue here? Or does that information only come out after it's been fully processed in the pathology department?
So that practice does vary internationally, and even within the UK, there's a lot of variation. So in my own practice, we used to have a pathologist who came and sat with us and would give us an idea, first of all, as to whether the target we had chosen contained malignant cells. Secondly, whether there was going to be adequate tissue for further testing. Over time, that obviously due to other pressures as well, we've lost our pathologist in our own centre, and that's actually been reflected in a lot of other centres in the UK and Europe. It's much better time spent for the pathologist to be in the laboratory reporting far more samples, perhaps, than looking at two or three in the morning that, that we would be able to do in the bronchoscopy suite. So I think that has evolved, and I think as long as we're working still closely with the pathologist and getting, you know, still quite quick feedback about individual patients, we can still learn about our practice and still hopefully improve so that we can get the best quality samples.
Absolutely. Nana, what about in Thailand? When you send a patient for a biopsy, is it usually a radiologist, surgeon, pulmonologist? Who does the biopsies, and how do you communicate the need for biomarker testing with those individuals?
So most of the situations in Thailand, so medical oncologists will prescribe and order the molecular testing. So, but we just communicate with them that we need like the bigger piece of the specimen, because of we need to send for either NGS or the single gene testing. And for the panel, it depends on, of course, it depends on the drug reimbursement, and it depends on the test reimbursement as well. But right now, so majority of us, we order EGFR ALK and PD-L1 at the very first visit when we saw the patients. But right now, I think majority of the oncologists in Thailand, we prefer to order like the small panel of the NGS, because the small panel, just like 10 genes or 12 genes, that is enough for lung cancer patients right now because of the drug. So, and the price of that small panel will be cheaper than the large panel.
Got it. So let me turn the to another set of sort of molecular testing, and that is in the field of liquid biopsies. And this is certainly something that in the U.S. has increased substantially over the last several years in multiple instances, including in somebody who's newly diagnosed with lung cancer. And there are multiple either institutional assays or commercial assays that are available to do that. In Thailand, do you use liquid biopsies at all, or do you only do tissue-based biopsies? And if you use liquid biopsies, when would you do that?
At the very first diagnosis, we prefer the tissue biopsy. But for the EGFR patients, and then when they fail osimertinib as a second line, so we prefer to do the liquid biopsy. But of course, right now it's not reimbursable. The patient have to pay out of pocket. And as I mentioned, it depends on the availability of the drug in Thailand right now, because right now we just have like capmatinib for the MET inhibitor, for the MET exon 14 splicing site, something like that. So, and for the liquid biopsy, right now we encourage the university-based institution in Thailand to do it by ourselves. That will cost the price of the test cheaper.
Yeah, I would say in the U.S., one advantage of liquid biopsies is speed. In that even most of the commercial assays turn around, an NGS panel in 7 days. And if you have institutional internal singleton assays, you can get a, EGFR mutation result in 2 to 3 days. So that is sometimes helpful if you need to treat somebody fast, if they're sick and can't necessarily wait for the 2 to 3 weeks for the tissue-based NGS. That is certainly one area where that ends up being used a lot in the U.S. Neil, what about in the UK in terms of liquid biopsies? Commonly used or not?
Yeah, I think to be fair, I think we've been a little bit slow on the uptake here with liquid biopsy in the UK. It was fairly routinely available after first line TKI, so it was being used and reimbursed for detection of the T790M mutation. But in terms of using it for diagnosis in the first line, sort of prior to first line treatment, it's not really taken off perhaps as much as it should do. And clearly that's partly due to reimbursement. But what you say, Patsy, about the turnaround time, I think is really important, because I think there's a real clear advantage there for liquid biopsy in patients with advanced disease. I, just from ESMO recently, the CLEAR trial sort of caught my eye, where they compared turnaround times from tissue to liquid biopsy, and the liquid biopsy to average, the median was 7 days compared to 27 days for tissue. Now, clearly in patients who are unwell, as you say, or perhaps, those with brain metastases and you want to get on and treat as quickly as possible, you want to know whether they have an EGFR mutation. I think they have a really important role there. I think I have a slightly different view in the early stage setting. So I think we do know that liquid biopsy perhaps has a slightly lower sensitivity in patients with earlier stage disease, and we still think that accurate nodal staging is really important. So I still think particularly endobronchial ultrasound and assessment of the mediastinum and accessing tissue at the same time, I still think has a really vital role in early stage disease. But I agree, I think in advanced stage disease, I think liquid biopsy, I think, needs to be used more and evaluated further so we can learn more about it.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think the emerging area in the early stage disease is for somebody who has had successful surgery and adjuvant therapy, and your question becomes, are they at risk for recurrence? And certainly very nice publications that have been done to date suggesting that if you can detect cfDNA or ctDNA post-treatment, you have an incredibly high risk of recurrence. And so I think this technological improvement to even in early stage disease will continue to help us and think about new and novel therapeutic studies and clinical trials to hopefully enhance the cure rate in the early stage disease. So I think lots of evolution in the space, which of course is great. And I agree with you that the extra 20 days of waiting is difficult for patients who are not well and just in general wanting to get to treatment faster. So again, we'll continue to hopefully see evolution in that. Okay, so let's turn on to our last topic. What are the options for patients progressing on EGFR inhibitors? So this too, I would say, is a very evolving field. And of course, it's an evolving field based on two different areas. One is what EGFR inhibitor did you initially receive? And for individuals who were treated with first and second generation EGFR inhibitors, we are very comfortable with the fact that there is essentially one dominant resistance mechanism, which is the EGFR T790M, accounting for somewhere in the 50 to 60% of resistance. There are others, MET amplification, HER2 amplification, histologic transformation into small cell, et cetera, but a limited scope. It is much more complicated and much more diverse following the treatment with first-line osimertinib. Yes, we see new new EGFR mutations and other oncogenic fusions. We see MET and HER2 amplification. We see small cell and squamous cell transformation. And then we have a fairly large piece of the pie that's still unknown. But unlike resistance to first-generation inhibitors, where there was one dominant resistance mechanism, that does not exist following first-line osimertinib treatment. And as such, the treatment paradigms of how do you best treat somebody following resistance to osimertinib continues to evolve. And there are a number of approaches, a number of trials, including things like the ORCHARD trial, which is trying to take a more of a platform approach to studying or treating resistance, to trials that focus on specific resistance mechanisms, and then a whole series of emerging therapies that either target again specific resistance mechanisms or use more broader strategies to target resistance, such as HER3 or HER2 antibody drug conjugates. So let's talk about treatment options and for patients progressing on EGFR TKIs. And maybe I'll start with Nana here. Tell us a little bit about what's your approach for somebody who's progressing. When do you decide to biopsy them in whatever means possible, and how do you use that information to guide treatment?
Yeah, for the situation in Thailand right now, as I mentioned, that we have the limited of the drug access after the patients fail EGFR TKI, especially in osimertinib. So the one thing that we have right now is named patient use for the capmatinib. So we're trying to find the patients who have the MET amplification or the MET exon 14 splicing site, and then ask the company to donate the drug for the patients. But the other options, so right now we don't have the amivantamab and the lazertinib. Even like we have the very useful data from the Chrysalis 1 and Chrysalis 2 data from ESMO this year. So, but we don't have that combination available in Thailand right now. So, for the patient who fail, we always go by the chemotherapy, the doublet platinum-based chemotherapy, or the regimen as the Empower 150, like doublet platinum-based chemotherapy, paclitaxel, carboplatin, plus the atezolizumab, and plus the bevacizumab. So that is the regimen. But these regimens, of course, we cannot reimburse. We can use just only the patients who pay out of pocket. And it depends on the patient performance as well.
And do you routinely, though, biopsy patients to look for MET amplification or small cell transformation or other things, or only in select cases?
Only select cases. So we'll do if I suspect it for small cell transformation, like the patient have very rapid disease progression as the small cell nature of disease. So we'll do the tissue biopsy because we cannot detect that in the liquid biopsy. But if we cannot access the tissues properly, we do the liquid biopsy in our institute.
Neil, you're probably called to help in this situation fairly often, someone progressing on an EGFR inhibitor. How do you, what are your sort of considerations when you're asked to biopsy somebody for progressive disease?
Yeah, I think this is going to be an increasingly important area, not just after first-line osimertinib, but I think after any first-line treatments, I think we're increasingly going to want to know what the resistance mechanism is. And as you highlighted in your slides, there's a significant proportion that have a phenotypic or histological transformation. So I think sort of slightly, almost slightly oddly, almost in the re-biopsy setting, but sort of in the relapse setting, biopsy is becoming almost more important, perhaps even than in the first line setting in this group. So I suppose a couple of key points here. One is the sooner that conversation happens, the better. Particularly, we all know, you know, patients with small cell lung cancer, as you say, can deteriorate very rapidly, and there can be a small window for a biopsy to take place, particularly when patients tend to be on aspirin or other anticoagulants that have to be stopped and so on. Though that week or so can be really crucial. So the earlier we know, I think, the better. And then I also think there's something about empowering the patients and letting the patients know, I think, during their treatment and having an idea to say, look, if something were to change, we might be considering a biopsy at some point. We've often had situations where patients have, you know, been rushed through for a biopsy very quickly when they haven't necessarily been prepared as well as they could have done in advance. So I think knowing about these patients as quickly as possible, even directly from our radiology colleagues, when the scan shows disease progression that's concerning for perhaps a transformation, that often triggers a notification to us. So yeah, but I think, as I say, this is going to be something that I think we're going to have to work on in the pulmonology and radiology communities better, because I think we're going to want to know about disease resistance in lots of settings.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the sort of diversity of resistance mechanisms here is certainly different. I would say for our own practice, this is one area where we sometimes do both a tissue-based biopsy as well as a liquid biopsy, because there's a nice data to suggest that the liquid biopsy is in a way a bit of a summation of resistance mechanisms that can be contributed from multiple different lesions, and you may only see something limited in one lesion. And I think getting a better understanding of the sort of is the resistance moving all towards one direction or multiple directions simultaneously, which may, of course, impact what you do for the patient next is important. And I would say we try also then to match the therapy, either using an approved therapy or clinical trial enrollment for individuals who we have a targetable alteration. And if we don't, then that's where chemotherapy comes into play, or some of these broader based strategies like the antibody drug conjugates, which seem to have activity in cancers that we don't have a particular resistance mechanism. Back to Nana on this. Again, the liquid biopsy question also in the resistance. Do you ever check the liquid biopsy or do a liquid biopsy before somebody has resistance to see how things are evolving in the blood? Or do you use it ever after you start a new therapy to guide to see how that changes over time?
So for the monitoring indication, so I would say that in Thailand, we don't really use this right now. Even we have the AURA3 study this year that shows some of the benefit of the liquid biopsy monitoring together with the some of the FLORA study information that show the liquid biopsy can probably show some early of the disease progression. But in Thailand, we don't really use this right now.
Great. And Neil, same question to you in terms of looking at liquid biopsies for progression versus tissue-based biopsies, practice patterns or use.
Yeah, currently, as I say, we're a little bit behind, I think, in the liquid biopsy use. And most of our most of our sort of resistance mechanism clarification is done by done by tissue currently. But as Nana just says, I really like the some of the Aura 3 data, and you know it's really easy to see how that could be put into practice going forward, where you know a simple blood test would give an idea and give a prediction of whether that patient was about to sort of develop disease recurrence. It would change the perhaps frequency of imaging and also communication with other multidisciplinary team members that, you know, maybe a biopsy might be required sooner rather than later in particular patients. So I think definitely, you know, look forward to seeing how that data evolves.
And Nana, one last question about treatment of resistance, frontline TKI therapy. What do you think is the most difficult resistance mechanism to treat, or what do you think is the clinically the most challenging scenario to treat when someone develops resistance?
That is the very nice question. So I think one of them that right now I have one patient who have the small cell transformation, and she's also have the MET amplification together with the EGFR pre-existing mutation. So it's very hard to treat, because when I treat the small cell transformation, and that worked for just like 1 or 2 months, and then she also have the disease progression again. So at some point, so I'm trying to treat all of the mechanism, but one at a time. But sometimes I have the TKI, the osimertinib, together with the chemotherapy. So, but that's hard, because her disease is very, very bad and a poor prognosis. So I think that's a hard and difficult situation if the patient have the combined resistant mechanism.
Yes, I think you bring up a very important point. Even though we like to think about these as independent pieces of the pie or slices of the pie, in reality, cancers can take on multiple resistance mechanisms simultaneously. And of course, that has the challenges, as you just point out, in terms of treatment. I will just end by saying that I personally think one big challenge is progressive CNS disease following osimertinib treatment, and what you do with individuals. And I think it's an area for us as a community to come together and start thinking about new approaches to treating CNS disease. Okay, so I will conclude our presentation. Thank you for watching this discussion about some recent developments in the management of patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. We hope it has been useful for you and help with your clinical practice.
Thanks for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this and related topics at www.touchoncology.com. Do keep checking back for any updates as we launch further activities in lung cancer.